Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Ignacio. Counsel for appellant. Oh, I'm sorry. One thing I should say before we begin is Judge Stuckey, who you did see earlier, will be participating on the record. Do you understand? Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Captain Michael Berry, along with Captain Paul LeBlanc. We represent Petty Officer Michael Ignacio. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Of course.
Your Honor. The crux of this case is a confusing sexual assault statute. It's confusing because normal people would not think to acquit someone accused of abusive sexual contact when the victim says no and pushes them away. That is exactly what must happen in an incapacity case such as this one. To be clear, this case is not about burden shifting or the constitutionality of the statute. This case is about whether the military judge should have instructed the members to consider consent when they determined whether the victim was incapacitated. The consent evidence at issue in this case is the following sequence of events. First, the victim observed Petty Officer Ignacio perform oral sex on him without objection or resistance.
But you're arguing but your problem is with the instruction, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you are arguing that the members were not told to consider the consent evidence. Is that correct?
Correct. Consent evidence with respect to the element of incapacity.
And why don't you walk us through the instruction that was given and indicate why it was flawed or not flawed, if you don't mind.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The instruction given simply told the members that consent was relevant and that it had been raised, that there was some evidence of consent and therefore that it was relevant.
But it said consent is relevant to whether the prosecution has proven the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. What is wrong with that instruction?
It's incomplete, Your Honor. It's insufficient to inform the members that they have a duty to consider, that they must consider consent both on its own independently and also with respect to incapacity. So simply saying consent is relevant does not do that. And in fact,
the instruction then says additionally consent is a defense to the charged offense.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. So whether he treats consent as an affirmative defense or a defense or even as an element of the crime, it doesn't matter. What matters and what this court has required is that the military judge carefully tailor his instructions using specific language and even a specific sequence to inform the members that they must consider consent with respect when they're deciding the issue of incapacity beyond a reasonable doubt. So what the military judge did in essence was he set the parameters for the playing field. And he said that he was going to define important terms. But what he never did was provide the rules for how that game was going to be played so that when the members went back to deliberate, they were not instructed adequately how they were supposed to use consent evidence. The instructions that he did give may have been legally correct, but they were incomplete, so they didn't go far enough.
What other area of law is there, at least in the military justice system, when something is considered to be relevant, and the judge must also add that you must consider it? Aren't the members required to consider all relevant evidence? Is there anything that is unique about this evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not necessarily what's unique about. Well, yes, Your Honor. What's unique about it is how closely related it is to the element of incapacity. And I'm not aware, to address what Your Honor said at first, I'm not aware of any other area of law. And that only highlights the importance of this issue because consent and incapacity are so closely related. There is a high potential for compartmentalizing those two when the members deliberate. And that is exactly why we require a military judge to use specific words and a specific sequence to make sure that the members don't do that. Otherwise, there's a risk that they will convict him simply based on the fact that there was no consent, that in this case the victim pushed him away and said, get off me. And the members will think, well, the judge told us the government has to prove no consent. well, there's no consent there. So we think he did it without the judge telling him, okay, but you also must consider consent with respect to deciding incapacity. So,
and was there a specific request for that instruction here?
Yes, there was, Your Honor. The defense requested that instruction, and the military judge actually agreed that he was bound by the law to give that instruction, but then he refused. He didn't give it.
Did the defense point that out?
They did not point that out, Your Honor, because to make any further objection would have been unnecessary at that point. It's a constitutionally and legally required instruction that the military judge was bound to give, and he simply didn't give it.
Did you indicate earlier that it was not a constitutionally required instruction?
No, Your Honor, if I did, I apologize, I misspoke. It is constitutionally required.
And why is it constitutionally required to emphasize something that's relevant that must be considered in a particular way?
Because there are two potentially exculpatory purposes for that consent evidence, Your Honor. The first is it can simply disprove the element of incapacity, or at least create reasonable doubt with respect to that element.
In which case, they wouldn't have proven that element beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
In which case, they would not have proven that element beyond a reasonable doubt.
Only if the judge had given that instruction, that would be true, Your Honor.
Well, no. I mean, if they needed to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, and if the military judge instructed them that the government had the burden to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't understand what the problem with the instruction is.
Because even if the government is successful in proving no consent beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence that the defense has raised to show consent must still be considered on the element of capacity, and likewise, the evidence that the government has provided. So in this case, that evidence was pushing Petty Officer Ignacio away and saying, get off me.
But if they're not convinced that he wasn't incapacitated, if they're convinced that he's incapacitated, then they have to find that he didn't consent.
And that's what we don't know happened here. We don't know whether that happened, Your Honor, because we without that instruction, there's no way to be sure, and this was highlighted in Humanic, that a reviewing court, such as this one, cannot be certain that the members used consent evidence for its proper purpose, for a beneficial purpose. So they could have simply decided that the victim was said no, but it's the manner by which if the victim is incapacitated, then of course he's incapable of saying no. But if the victim says no, then he's not incapacitated. So that's a potentially exculpatory purpose for which consent can be used. And without that carefully tailored instruction telling the members you must consider it in that manner, then again, there's no way to be sure on appellate review, that the members did not improperly compartmentalize that evidence. And that actually brings me to the two reasons why that instruction has been required. First, it prevents the risk of that compartmentalization, it prevents the members from not considering consent for its proper and beneficial purposes. And second, as I just mentioned, it would allow reviewing courts to determine whether the conviction is simply based on lack of consent or if it's based on proof of all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, earlier we were discussing the question of whether the defense requested a specific instruction and whether the judge granted that. And you indicated that the judge did not give the instruction requested by the defense, but didn't give an explanation. Could you take a look at page 25 of the joint appendix? It looks to me there that the judge is giving an explanation as to why the judge did not give the instruction requested by the defense. And where did the judge err, if at all, on page 25 of the joint appendix?
Your Honor, when the judge says, however, the court will not utilize the exact wording requested by the defense, at that point, reading his explanation there, he's talking about critical information regarding the definition of consent. And then the following several paragraphs then go on to highlight the burden-shifting problems that were raised in United States versus Prater. So nowhere does he explain his rationale for not giving the requested instruction on both uses of consent. He simply says this court grants the defense request. So there was his discussion from that point on was about whether he was going to give the whether the requested instruction had properly defined the terms. And whether or not it was consistent with Prather with regard to the burden shift. But he doesn't actually the instructions with regard to consent and incapacity, there's two related but distinct instructional issues that arise.
I understand that. But where did the defense say to the judge, Judge, I understand what you're saying on one issue but not the other? In other words, did we're not talking about whose responsibility it was at this point. I'm just trying to understand the dynamic of the trial. Did the defense at any point say, but you haven't addressed my other request, and somehow segregate that request for the must consider as a separate request?
They did not make a further request, Your Honor, and any further request would have been unnecessary.
I understand that. I understand your argument.
This court has recognized repeatedly that the instruction is so important that it has to be given using specific words in a specific way. That is, that the members must consider consent when they're determining whether incapacity has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And then they also must consider whether consent has been proved. These are, again, two potential avenues for acquittal for an accused.
This you're focusing, of course, on the word must, but the defense's own proposed instruction used the word may, did it not?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
If the defense requested may, and now you're arguing they should have had must, that's somewhat awkward, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is an application of Prather and Neal, which both a Prather at issue there was whether may was sufficient, and
focusing on this argument at the appellate level, the must versus may argument.
Yes, sir, because it's still an unresolved issue.
Isn't actually the defense request incorrect and Prather correct, in that if something's relevant, the members must consider it. It would almost sound like jury nullification if the members could say, well, there's relevant evidence and we won't consider it. They may decide that the evidence doesn't warrant any particular action or that it's not credible, but under what theory would the judge ever instruct the members that they don't need to consider evidence that was introduced at trial?
That situation wouldn't arise, Your Honor, where they would.
So isn't must always?
Yes,
part of the responsibility of the court members, they must consider all the evidence that was introduced. They can decide what weight, if any, to give it.
That's correct, Your Honor, but that, again, would be insufficient in a case such as this when there is such a close relationship between incapacity and consent.
I understand the argument you're making, but what I'm trying to get at is why is there anything remarkable about the language in Prather in that regard? Isn't Prather simply stating the ordinary course of action in a trial? That is, that when relevant evidence is introduced, it must be considered by the jury, it must be considered by the members, and then they can decide what weight, if any, to give it?
No, Your Honor, because of the nature of that relationship, it's not enough to just say you must consider all relevant evidence. Again, this goes back to the analogy of that's simply establishing the parameters for what evidence will be considered.
Right, but did Prather identify this as a unique requirement with respect to the laws at issue, as opposed to identifying what the ordinary course of action would be with respect to relevant evidence?
It's unique in that.
I'm not asking for your view. I'm asking about Prather itself. Did Prather itself say we've got a unique problem here and this evidence must be considered even though it may be disregarded?
Prather doesn't call it unique, Your Honor, but it says that when there is an overlap between evidence pertinent to the affirmative defense and then the evidence negating an element. So this court appeared and prayed to be establishing this is the scenario when this arises, and this case fits within that box, Your Honor, that there is that consent element relevant to both the affirmative defense or the defense, in this case, as the judge labeled it, and the element of the offense. The lower court in this case held that they agreed that the instruction was not given, but they held that it wasn't required because the military judge's instructions overall obviated any burden on Petty Officer Ignacio. But that conflates the issues. The issue, again, is not about burden shifts or the statutory scheme and whether it's constitutional. It's about whether the members received the correct instructions when they went back to deliberate. In this case, they did not, and the government cannot prove that this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. To conclude, this instruction was constitutionally required because it could have potentially resulted in an acquittal for Petty Officer Ignacio. Because the military judge did not give it, Petty Officer Ignacio was deprived of due process, and the government cannot prove that it did not contribute to his conviction. This court should reverse the lower court and set aside his conviction for abuse of sexual contact.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, and may it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Benjamin Bosgardner, and I, along with Colonel Brubaker, represent the United States in this case. This court should affirm the lower court's ruling for three reasons. One, there was no instructional error. The members were properly instructed. Two, to the extent that a dual-use instruction was provided and was required when it was provided. And three, even should this court find error, it should test for plain error. An appellant cannot carry his burden under that test. The members were properly instructed, and this court said as much in United States v. Medina. The military judge provided a legally sufficient rationale for deviating from the statutory scheme and shifting the burden for the affirmative defense of consent from the appellant onto the government. The military judge provided clear instruction that clearly conveyed the government's burden and how the evidence was to be used. There was no error, and a dual-use instruction was not required. Dual-use instruction is required in situations where an appellant carries a burden, and the utility of dual-use instruction in that context is to ensure that they don't disregard evidence that could raise a reasonable doubt merely because they failed to carry their burden with regards to the affirmative defense. Here, they had no burden, and accordingly, there was no risk that the members would disregard the evidence that they put forward. The instruction as a whole was lawful, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment. In United States v. Medina, the court noted that the military judge's decision to utilize the bench book instruction instead of the statutory instruction was problematic because the military judge didn't provide a legally sufficient rationale for why he deviated from the statutory scheme. In this case, the military judge went to pains to articulate why he was deviating from the statutory scheme. He analyzed the law itself, he analyzed Congress's intent, he analyzed this court's holding in Neal, which at the time of his trial was the most recent case on this particular issue. He explained his understanding of how the members would understand this instruction as an if-then-riddle that looped back around upon itself. And then he concluded that the only reasonable way he could instruct upon this was to utilize the benchmark instruction. We argue that in this context, where the military judge provides a legally sufficient rationale for deviating from the statutory scheme, this court should find that there was no instructional error. Even if this court were to determine that the military judge needed to use a dual-use instruction, and again, we argue that no dual-use instruction was necessary here, but should this court determine that a dual-use instruction was necessary, a proper dual-use instruction was given. The question is whether or not an instruction is adequate to convey to the jury that all the evidence, including evidence of the affirmative defense, must be considered in deciding whether or not there's reasonable doubt. Here, the military judge explained to the members that the affirmative defense of consent had been raised and that it was the government's burden to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and that evidence of consent was relevant to whether or not the government proved the other elements of the crime beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, Wasn't it also, is it relevant as well, or not relevant, that they were instructed about the effect of lack of capacity on the ability to consent? Framed another way, isn't it true that they were also instructed on the effect of lack of capacity on the ability to consent?
Yes, Your Honor. They were, they were instructed that they needed to consider the evidence of consent for whether or not it affected the other elements of the crime, including lack of capacity, which the military judge had defined a few paragraphs before in the record. A reasonable jury would understand that evidence of consent in this case, and frankly, in this case, there wasn't much evidence of consent. The evidence of the consent argument came out in the defense attorney's closing argument. There wasn't really much evidence of consent. But a reasonable juror would understand that anything they understood to be evidence of consent, they should apply the other elements of the crime, including substantial incapacitation. Which brings me to the standard that this court should use when assessing whether or not instructions were proper. And that is, pardon me, Your Honor, whether the court must evaluate the instruction in the context of the overall message conveyed to the jury. And that comes from United States v. Prather. Here there is nothing confusing about the instructions that were provided to this jury. A reasonable jury and a reasonable juror would understand that evidence of consent had been raised and that they were required to consider it for whether or not it proved that the sexual act had occurred, whether or not there was substantial incapacitation. There was nothing at all confusing about these instructions. I'd like to discuss briefly the proper test that this court should use should it decide that there was error in this case. We believe plain error is the proper test. The military judge, after a robust discussion with the parties as to how he should instruct the members, presented his proposed instruction, and on page 24 of the joint appendix, specifically solicited objections from counsel. There was none. In fact, the trial defense counsel raised other objections and brought other things to the military judge's attention, but appeared to have no issue at all with the proposed instruction. In this context, we would argue that any error was waived or forfeit, absent plain error. There is a long history of this court, testing instructional error for plain error. I'll start as far back as Smith, which I cited supplementarily, and go forward to Pope, for example, where again this court utilized a plain error test. The government argues that the proper plain error test is a standard three-prong test where the appellant carries the burden on all three prongs. In this case, the appellant cannot show that he was prejudiced. There was clear evidence of him being asleep at the time that the sexual assault began. He wakes up, he realizes what's occurring, he has a freak out. He curses at the appellant, he jumps up, he runs out, he returns to his ship, he immediately reports, and he reports in a state of hysterics. He's clearly emotional. And the only evidence that the defense put on to really question this was, A, the fact that he ejaculated at the end of it, but again, that occurs as he's waking up.
You're not suggesting that the defense had any burden to put on any evidence whatsoever, are you?
No, not at all, ma'am. But in terms of this court's prejudice analysis, when determining whether or not the appellant was prejudiced, I think it's proper to consider the evidence that came forward during the trial that the jury considered when deciding whether or not the accused was guilty.
Is your argument that there's no evidence of consent, or that there's some evidence of consent?
Your Honor, the evidence of frankly, I would argue that there's no evidence of consent.
Is that what your brief argues, or?
Your Honor,
appellant's defense was that the victim consented, right?
The appellant's defense was that he ejaculated, and that in and of itself was evidence that there was consent. And the appellant never took the stand and argued that he consented.
Did the judge instruct that they're on consent?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
Well, did he base that on the existence of some evidence, or did he just decide to do it for the heck of it? What was going on in this case?
Your Honor, I would argue that in an abundance of caution, the military judge instructed on consent. And the majority of the consent argument came in the closing argument, which is not evidence. The evidence of consent was minimal. What the trial defense counsel focused on was the fact.
Is minimal the same as none? Was there some evidence upon which the judge based that instruction, or did he just instruct on it because he wanted to instruct on everything that an appellate court might think ought to come up in a case?
Your Honor, I put it like this. The fact that the appellant ejaculated would provide grounds for a person to make an argument that he consented. I think that if there's any argument to be made, it would be a retroactive consent, which we know from Traylor this court doesn't recognize. Whether or not the military judge knew that at the time, I'm not educated enough to speak on. We would argue that there was no evidence of consent. However, it was argued in closing, and in abundance of caution, the military judge provided the affirmative defense of consent instruction in accordance with the bench book. Regardless of the test that this court uses to assess prejudice, whether it's plain error or harmless beyond reasonable doubt, again, we think that the proper test is plain error where the appellant bears the burden. But nonetheless, there was overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case. And again, there was the realization of what was occurring, the cursing, the pushing the appellant off, the immediate report, and the hysterics afterwards.
To be clear, your main argument is there is no error in this case. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you're arguing in the alternative? So we should not rely on how much time you're spending on each of your arguments to determine which is your best argument, correct?
Sir, undoubtedly my best argument is that there was no instructional error in this case. Sir, the military judge had a legally sufficient rationale for deviating from the statutory scheme. There was no error in this case. And even to the extent that there may have been error, there was no prejudice in this case. Accordingly, this court should affirm the lower court's ruling. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, opportunity for rebuttal, please.
Your Honors, the government wants this court to look at this or analyze this in the same way that it did in Medina. But this case, this is not Medina, because although this court said the instructions in Medina were clear, the appellant in Medina did not argue that they were incomplete and that they failed to direct the members to consider consent for its proper purpose. Again, the government says that the instructions in this case were clear and there was nothing confusing about them. That is not the issue. The issue is that they were incomplete. The instructions that he did give may have been correct, but they were incomplete. The government also says that a reasonable juror would understand what they should consider, what evidence they should consider when going back to deliberate with respect to consent and incapacity. But that's precisely what this court has held might not happen, and that's why the instruction is required, because the members might not go back and realize that they must consider consent with respect to incapacity. So again, this is one of the few, or perhaps the only, circumstance in which we require judges to be mindful of the content and sequential nature of those instructions. If there are no further questions, that concludes my response.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until quarter of the hour, 10:45.
Court stands in recess until 10:45.